Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week, two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his friend who's just too cute and adorable to exist, Duncan Nichol.
It doesn't get much further from the straight razor's cure than this. This week, we read The Moomins.
That we did. We read Finn Family Moomins. Like a little ball of delight and childish nostalgia for me.
Now, Duncan, this was not childish nostalgia for me. I only learned that the Moomins existed sometime in the mid-2020s when for some reason, and I said some reason, but I know the reason, it was the pandemic. During the pandemic, a lot of people got really into the Moomins. And I was like, what on earth is going on? Why are these weird hippos having wholesome family adventures? Huh? Is this witch a boy or a girl?
I mean, I don't even know who you're referring to in that moment. But you're right, it definitely had a resurgence in the pandemic. Most likely because it is one of those really wholesome stories. I would say this is like Winnie the Pooh levels of just cozy, don't you worry, the world will be a good place to you. And people like that. I like that. I say it's part of my childhood. I should actually clarify. The TV show was a bit of part of my childhood. It was actually my partner who had all the books and read them all through when she was a child. This is still my first time reading a Moomin novel cover to cover.
Now, Duncan, as the Moomin expert of the two of us, can you tell me a little bit about the series and where are we in it? I assume this is the first novel. It does feel like I'm being introduced to Moominess.
Well, you'd be absolutely wrong. Finn Family Moomin is the book I picked this for this episode of the podcast because it's sort of, it feels like the first one, although it technically isn't. The first one is actually Comet in Moomin Valley, an event that is vaguely referenced in this book. And in fact, there's even one that predates that, sort of a Moomin Zero, called The Moomins and the Great Flood, which takes our cuddly hippo characters, the Moomins, on their journey to arrive at this sort of peaceful valley that they live in. The reason why I picked
this, a sort of land before time, but for Moomins.
Very much so, and a lot of the characters that they're friends with, they do meet for the first time in those earlier novels. The reason I pick this book in particular, and why I actually recommend it, firstly, it's a lot more, in my opinion, representative of what the Moomins sort of go on to be and mean for sort of the rest of the series. The first two, we've got a grand flood and the threat of a comet striking and killing them all. Like, they're weirdly high tension, and it's not necessarily that they're bad in any way, but I don't think they're the most representative. I think they're good to go back and experience once you're kind of establishing you've brought into the cozier vibes of the later books. Another point why I picked this one to start with is that lots of people start with this one because actually the kind of most well-known TV show started with this book. If you watch The Moomin, I'm going to say the 80s version, probably 90s, not 100% sure. That actually starts the adaptation of Finn Family Moomin. And when I talk to my partner and I talk to her family, I go, I'm doing the first Moomin book. Everyone points to this one, even if the technicality is that it's not quite technically the right one. It's certainly the one I just recommend. And as you've said, you thought it was the first book because it functions like a first book.
Duncan, I just got to say, I just quickly, whilst you were saying that, went to the Moomin Wikipedia page to to check out when the TV show might have come out, so I could tell you if it was the 80s or not. I did not realize that the Moomins were first written in 1945. So this is just a tail end of World War II.
And to be fair, that really captures those first two books about a wholesome family coming through a horrific event and settling again.
I hate to think what Papa Moomin did in the Winter War, you know. It brings a whole new meaning to the White Death.
Sorry, I wasn't expecting that. It does make me think what he's writing, Moomin Papa's writing in his journals.
His memoirs.
Just getting it all out there.
The siege of Leningrad was in its second year. Wicked smell will rot from within the city. Okay, this is too great. So Duncan asked me before the episode, because we always start with, except for this time, I guess, hey, what have you been reading? And I said, I really don't want to talk about it, because I'm still reading Berlin, and I know way more about the Holocaust than I used to. And I've got to say, Duncan, The Moomins was actually a real nice breath of fresh air when I first started reading it. Because I'm reading through, I'm like, this is so much lighter and funnier and sweeter than learning about the encroachment of the Red Army on Prussia. And I was very pleased by that.
I mean, I'm happy for you. And yeah, I would hope you would have found it that. If you come to me going, actually, Duncan, there's a hell of a lot of similarities I'm seeing, I would have been just deeply concerned. That's good. Was it like a nice counterbalance? And very much for me, this has been a very nice palate cleanser for the year we've had. As you alluded earlier, we've had Black Company, we've had books written by war vets, like, we've had some really heavy stuff. I just really wanted to just strike out back towards kind of the Narnia level of fantasy, because it's equally part of it.
It's more wholesome than Narnia. There's no one selling their family out to, you know, powers or authority, and no one's running anyone through with any swords. There was more peril than I expected, to be honest. Like, when they go on their little fishing trip, their little boat trip to the island, and there's a storm, I'm like, oh no, they could drown. This is kind of dangerous. Someone gets attacked by birds. Not birds. Flying monsters.
It's wholesome and cute, but it's not dull. There are stakes in here. So, Joe, I should probably tell you what I've also been reading before we go shooting into the review of the novel. Geordie.
Yeah, the breakneck pace of the Moomins demands that we hold nothing back and we go in all guns blazing.
I need to tell you, I am so happy at the moment because I've made a purchase and I have finally got my hands on something that I have been hunting for years.
Okay, I can't even imagine what it is. I'm assuming this is some elusive Conan collection. That's my guess.
Oh, he knows me so well. Yes, it is, exactly. I have finally got my hands on Conan the Adventurer and Just Conan, brought as a job lot, the Marvel comic series that took over when the original coloured Conan the Barbarian ended back in 93 and then ran for subsequently about 2 years between them. So 25 issues of like Marvel Conan that it's never been collected. These series have just not been stuck on the omnibus, so the only way to hunt them down has been original issues. And I finally did it. And I spent some money.
Well done.
And
oh dear.
They're okay.
I'm pleased to hear that, Dunk. What is it, like, adapting particular stories or are these originals?
These are all originals. The Conan the Adventurer, it was written by Roy Thomas, a big name in the Conan comic space. It's 14 issues. And they're all
see our episode on the history of Conan fanfiction.
Absolutely. And they're all set within sort of the events of like the first three issues of the original Conan the Barbarian comic series. So pre the character of Conan the Barbarian ever reaching civilization for the first time, or at least his like thief adventures. This is all him in his like early younger days. It has a bit of a story arc about a magic talisman, and it's generally quite good. It's sort of all over and done in sort of 14 issues, this one arc. It's really interesting though, at least I find it interesting, because when you have an issue, you get all like the letter pages where people were writing in fan letters like back then, and they would be published and then like responded to. And it's really fun to kind
of... Those are legitimately really interesting. I remember reading a lot of those when I was picking up Invincible comics. And reading letters to Robert Kirkman, and you get to see them actually respond to people. It's very cool and interesting.
It is. It's nice to see like how people felt at the time and expectations, and it's really nice to see this like comic people writing in and then responding, going, "I'm so glad you rebooted it. This is such a great reboot." Roy going, "Don't you, Roy? I hope this to have an equally long run as the original 270 issues. Here we go." And then you get to issue 14. They're like, "Yeah, no, Marvel pulled the plugs, guys. Sorry." And then the second thing I read was the follow-up to that series, another reset to number one, just called Conan by Marvel, and I'll tell you now, Geordie, it is the most horrifically, mind-bogglingly bad written Conan I've ever experienced.
Strong words, Duncan.
They are strong words. I think it's very interesting, and listen, this is very much me explaining like an interest in comics, because it's that mid-90s, we're kind of shifting into digital colours. You know, the styles are changing. It's becoming more modern, but it's not there yet. And it's really interesting to read a comic not written by Roy Thomas, who I felt like really got the character, but like people, I think Chuck Dixon wrote like a few issues. It's almost like...
Oh, not Chuck. I have no idea who that is.
Chuck Dixon, he wrote Nightfall in Batman. Bane. That's all his work.
Okay.
And he's actually written some Conan novels. He's clearly a man that loves Conan the Barbarian. This is what's really weird. Imagine someone who like loves a character, but loves a completely different aspect of the character than you do. So in all his work, he plays up
I know that.
The wrong, in my head, you know, the wrong element. His Conan is the brawn, toxic masculinity, hyper-masculine, aggressive representation with none of the sort of the nuance and the kind of playoff about, you know, barbarianism and civilization and the, you know, the sort of simple honour. Those elements that make the character interesting, he takes a very simplistic approach. But what's kind of extra interesting is like he's taking the simplistic approach, but not because he's lazy. He's clearly a fan. He's just a fan like the wrong way. I don't want to say the wrong way, because that makes me feel very gatekeepery. I don't want to be like that. Obviously, you can like the character for those elements, but he plays them up in his written work to the point of which I'm like, what is this? This is not the same. What have you done?
This is legitimately why comic books are bad. And I've said it with a lot of confidence, which is that you have runs that go really well. You have writers who are very skilled, who get the character, and they get to do it for, like, I don't know, 20 whole issues. And then some fucking hack just takes over, ruins the whole thing, changes the canon. All the plans get thrown out the window. It's impossible to write long-term stories because everything gets reset back to what the next writer's idea of the new normal should be. And you can never expect any kind of consistency.
I mean, I totally agree. It's like, I love reading comic books. I read a lot of comic books. I'm a big fan of the Batman. Shocker, I know, that obscure piece of work. But I've now read quite a lot, like, a lot now of Batman. And one thing you kind of realise is the fact that, yes, you got great runs, and you got great villains, and great mysteries, and great action scenes. But eventually, you just get tired, because you see Bruce Wayne look like he's about to do character growth, and then someone has to swoop in and be like, no. Can't do that. We won't be able to write new stories if he has character growth. We won't sell comic
books if Batman changes.
Anyway, where were we? Ah, yes. Moomins.
The Moomins.
Our breath of fresh air.
So, Duncan, this story, as much as it is chill and wholesome and all that, a lot more happens in it than I genuinely expected. It's not a long story, but it's really a collection of, like, 7 short stories that take place in order. It's a series of adventures. It's just that people don't really wander far. They don't leave Moomin Valley to have these adventures. There's a magical hat. There's strange creatures running about. There's a hobgoblin. There's a ruby. There's all sorts.
That there is. So, Geordie, before we kind of dive in and break this apart even more, let's just go for the top level question. Did you enjoy the Moomins? Oh, so I was hoping for a quicker yes there. You've taken me back with that sigh. I hope you're okay.
Well, that's the thing, which is that I did like the Moomins for a little bit. I really liked the first 2 stories. I just enjoyed the vibe. I enjoyed the slow, methodical pace. I enjoyed just the writing. I really, really liked the bit where it starts off with a letter written by Mama Moomin, and then you just see them waking up after you know, after the hibernation's done and they're getting things back together, that's all very sweet. And then you start to mix in some chaotic elements with this magical hat that causes things to change. And then I kind of had a bad week, you know? And suddenly there was this friction between I need to enjoy reading about this nice wholesome stuff happening and nice wholesome stuff isn't actually happening to me. And after that, the Moomins actually became quite grating, and I really didn't want to spend more time with them. And even though I did occasionally laugh at a joke, I really wasn't that engaged with them anymore, because a lot of the time, when I'm reading fantasy novels, I'm seeing people go through really hard experiences. I actually found it a lot easier to compare my mundane but challenging experiences to those ones than to blissful peace. So yeah, I really wasn't able to bring my A game to enjoying the Moomins.
Well, firstly, I'm so sorry to hear that you've had kind of such a rough week, mate. And it's interesting you say, like, with the Moomins, you kind of found the wholesomeness almost, you say almost like sickly, or it just was detached from your kind of experience?
It wasn't sick. So detached is better, because it wasn't like sickly sweet. It wasn't like, oh, this is too much. It was well written, it was cute, and I liked it, but I just wasn't able to connect with it. And I feel like a really great way to experience this book would be to, like, read it to your kid or your nephew or just a kid you're babysitting, like, two chapters at a time over a couple of weeks, and not mainlining it in a week for your podcast.
I think it's, you know, it's fair to recognise when maybe you're not traditionally the target audience for a piece. I think it is important. And I'm really happy that you identified there, well, who you do think the target audience and who you would really recommend it for.
Yeah, I mean, it is a kid's book. And not even a kid's book like Percy Jackson. It's about an adventure. Adventures are exciting. Anyone can enjoy that. This is a kid's book, capital K.
To kind of put it on the scale, this is, you know, before Narnia, this is Winnie the Pooh territory of comparison.
Exactly.
From my experience, I still had a really nice time with it.
I'm very pleased to hear that.
I found it very wholesome. I particularly loved the family dynamic. And what I find quite enjoyable about this book is the fact that the world isn't completely perfect. There are still threats and there are still concerning things to the characters. But what I think sort of captures it for me is that most of the threats come across more environmental and not through sort of malicious actors. There's something about, like, this is a wholesome place because the characters and the people that inhabit it are just nice people. And if everyone's just being a nice person...
It's just like how I would love to live on the Starship Enterprise D. Even though it's constantly in peril, it would be really nice to be surrounded by good, kind people who are good at their jobs and always try to do the right thing. That's nice. I would accept a lot of actual danger to live in a comforting space like that.
So let's talk about those characters. Obviously, we've got the lead, our Moomin, our little Moomin, or Moomin Troll, as they refer to.
I'd like to pause right here. So, as any listener who has not even read the books yet or seen the TV show knows, obviously, the race of creatures we're talking about are called Moomins. This one is called Moomin Troll. A troll in, like, a lot of Nordic cultures means, like, monster or strange creature. So this guy's name is, like, Human Man. That's what his name is. It's like, oh yes, this is my son, Human Man. I guess the name Guy does exist.
I think that's a good argument. I also find it quite interesting because we say the race of the Moomins, although there are some And you've got the core family, the Moomin family, consisting of Moomin Troll, Moomin Mama, Moomin Papa. But there are other...
Yeah, the person family.
Moomins. Because you have the character, his Moomin Troll sort of girlfriend of Snork Maiden and her brother Snork. So are they the Snork family? Is there a Snork Mama and a Snork Papa just off page somewhere?
I think that because Moomin Troll is our hero, his parents are called Moomin Papa because that's dad. You know, it's dad of a capital D. That's why he's Moomin Papa. No one else is calling him Moomin Papa. I mean, maybe Moomin Mama is calling him Moomin Papa, but in the same way that when your mum speaks to you about your dad, she might say dad.
I think that flies. So where was I? I was going through the characters. So we have our principle of our core family, Moomin Troll, Moomin Mama, Moomin Papa. But they have and they live in Moomin Valley, in Moomin House. And they have a lot of friends that come and live with them. We have, like I mentioned, Snork Maiden, her younger brother Snork. We have the very close friend of Sniff, who is kangaroo-esque, I will describe them.
Yeah, sure.
And then we have one other character who's consistently around, who I'm genuinely going to say, just I think rocks like the low-key cool guy energy, like... so much harder than I would ever expect out of this book. And that is Snufkin.
Snufkin, yeah. So, Duncan, when I was talking about the time on Twitter when the Moomins really made it big for some reason, I watched a lot of that, like, without turning on the audio or something, maybe. And I was pretty convinced Snufkin was a lady. So, when I found out he was a guy, I was like, I really just can't cross those bridges in my head. I think this one's still a girl, sorry.
I mean, I would first say, probably does not matter within the confines of this story. Whatever
sure.
gender was applied to this character. And this, I think, is a kind of a core cast of adventurers. They go off, they meet other ones as we go through the short stories. So, Geordie, did you have the favourite? Are you a Snufkinner? I've just made that term up. As many are you like, this guy has
yeah,
got
sure.
it going.
The Snufkins are okay. I like Moomin Troll. I like Snork Maiden. I like Wendigo on a little family excursion. There's one bit I really liked with Moomin Mama, which is that they find a boat and they have to name the boat. And they all go down the list, blah, 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 blah. They all give terrible names. And then Moomin Papa says, you know, this is Moomin Mama's excursion. Why didn't she name the boat? And Moomin Mama stays very demure and nice and says, no, no, no. Snufkin has such a great imagination. We should look to Snufkin for advice. And Snufkin says something like, I don't know, I think we should name it Creeping Wolf. And she says, no, let's not call it that. I'm going to call it The Adventure. And I really liked that moment because Moomin Mama is so sweet and wholesome and like, typical 1940s domestic person, and then it's like, actually, I do know a little better than you, and I'm going to ignore the silly thing you just said.
You want to see a moment of Moomin Mama was such a great energy in this book. This is genuinely the only line I wrote down from this novel, because like, I need to say this out loud when we talk about Moomin Mama. So this is a book where a creature known as a snork has come. And they've all been woken up, and they're all panicking, and they're all grabbing weapons and like running downstairs to see off the snork. And the snork sort of just looks at them and like wanders away. And then Moomin Mama comes out with this. This is the line: "Can we go back to bed now?" asked Moomin Mama, putting down her axe. Good on you, Mama. It's not even lying when she picks it up. It's just like she just sort of has it. In that scene, she's just like, right, I will defend my house to the death. And as soon as it's gone, she's like, okay, back to bed, children. Put the axe back on the wall.
It is good. Yeah, that's the sort of thing that is nice about this book, Vader. It has this... It has such a deliberate sense of peace and ease to it that... It's genuinely just funny sometimes, like, how mellow these little creatures are. You've got people... My favourite part of the book is, like, in... I think it might be chapter 2, when they... Before they discover the magical shape-shifting properties of the Hobgoblin's hat. And when they're playing hide-and-seek, Moomin Troll puts it on, and he's described that all of his body proportions reverse, and then this bit plays out where, you know, like, he doesn't realize he looks like something else. He thinks everyone else is playing along and is pretending to not recognize him. And I think this bit is really funny. He introduces himself. They say, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm the president of America. I'm the king of America." And they say, "Well, he must be that because he looks very strange. He must be from America." Later, he insults Moomin Troll as though he's not him, and they are so outraged by this that they jump on him and start beating him up.
It does give us this really fun edge of, like, they're all sweet and they're all kind and they're all, like, chill until you threaten one of them and it's just like, no. We have an edge. We're just nice until, you know, see, we'll play nice, but if you start playing mean, oh, you don't want to see what it looks like. Like, that is sort of this fight, and it's so fun when it comes out.
I really liked also the, like, wish-granting scene at the end of the book, especially with Snork Maiden. So they all get a chance, they're rewarded by the Hobgoblin for returning the hat, I guess, and they all get to be granted wishes. And they all ask kind of for, like, sweet but frivolous things. Snork Maiden, to make a long story short, wishes she had prettier eyes, and she then gets them, and then Moomin Troll's like, "That sucks, I really liked your eyes." And she's like, "Oh, well, now I want them changed back." And then they go for this long debate about who should use their wish to get Snork Maiden her real eyes back. And I love the bit with her brother, Snork, where he's like, "Well, I don't want her to have her eyes back because I have a really great wish. I want a machine that can tell truth from lies, good from evil, all these grand things." No, Hobgoblin says, "I can't do that. That sounds too hard." "Oh, can I have a typewriter then?" Anyway, that sense of friction between the frivolity that's inherent to the Moomins and moments of genuine drama, of threat, of, like, importance, it generates a real... a great energy to the book. There's a reason why it's not boring. You know, it's, even though so much of this book is about everything's kind of okay, it's not boring because everything being okay is paralleled with these little moments of friction, of topsy-turviness.
I agree. And let's talk about some of those. So the first story, and something that kind of underpins the majority of the novel, is the Hobgoblin's hat. Now, the Hobgoblin, as sort of characterised here, is much more like just like a man in sort of description and look, who rides through the sky on the back of a black... is it a black panther? And I mean, firstly, is this someone else's folklore or this pure fantasy to the Moomins?
I think it might be of that certain level where this is an old book written for kids, so just having an animal that's from somewhere else is pretty exciting.
Well, the Hobgoblin loses their hat, which is the top hat, by the way, because the Hobgoblin has style. And they quickly discover that anything that falls into this hat is magically transformed. Obviously, we talked about when Moomin gets transformed, but the sort of first little adventure they have... it's when they throw some, like, eggshells into it and little clouds appear. And they ride about on the clouds. So I was about to have talked about conflict. This actually isn't the conflict. The conflict's a scene later. But I want to talk about this first. This is the first bit of pure childhood, like, whimsy of just, like, come on, kids, let's have fun.
Exactly.
I think it sets, like, a tone of that. Most of, like, the adventures that we go on are a sense of, like, come on, let's go have fun. There will be some stakes to the fun, like, I don't know, as a child you go scrambling over the rocks down the beach. Obviously, it is slightly dangerous, but it's all done in the sense of, let's go have an adventure, let's go and look over there.
Part of the reason why I think people really honed in on the Moomins during the pandemic especially, and I'm aware, sort of lodging my appreciation for the Moomins in my personal context of my familiarity with it, but that's how I experience everything, so what else am I going to do? And I think the reason why people really fell back into that was not merely everything's kind of fine, everything's kind of all right, everything's kind of sweet, there's not that much danger. It's also a blissful longing for a carefree pastoral existence. Because a big appeal, I think, to people, at least modern readers, is it's about a peaceful life in the countryside. And the bit where, like, they go to the beach and they take a boat ride to an island really vividly brought me back to being a kid in the countryside, where we lived on a river, we lived next to the Ouse, and we took little boat rides down the River Ouse. And when we did come to tiny little islands that are like 3 meters across, I would treat it like we had found like a pirate treasure island, and it would be a great adventure to get out onto this tiny little weed-covered island.
Well, that's... okay, that's incredibly sweet. Sadly, I can't... I wish I could be like, oh, I had equal adventures. I live by the ocean. The ocean is much scarier, but...
it's a fearsome beast.
It is indeed, as the Moomins discover. I really enjoyed the writing, by the way, over these sections. There's a section when... after that boat ride where they're on an island, and they kind of just have to camp down for the night as a storm blows over. And just the way this is written, there's a sense, Geordie, if you go camping quite a lot and hiking, you know that kind of feeling you get.
Yeah, I'm going
of,
again next month.
Oh, well, have fun, mate. This, the feeling you get when you're sort of just in from a storm. And when I say just, I don't mean like time, I mean... you've got a shelter that is just working enough. You can kind of sense the elements.
Oh, yeah.
But you're protected by them. And it gives me, and judging by your phrase there, like you, that sort of this, I don't know what this special feeling is. It's so hard to pin down of like coziness or like inherent, like, I have done it. I have built my little bit of safety. And damn it, this section of the book nailed that in written form. And I find it so rare to get that sensation put across. And it's fun because it's a small scene, but it really connected me to like that very lived experience and that sense of being out in the countryside. Like you had that similar experience.
Absolutely.
On the river.
Thank you for calling that out, because I did have a very... last time I went camping... no, not last time. Last year when I went camping and I was in Sweden. Hey, that's almost relevant to this book. This book is not Swedish, but it was published in Swedish. And it's next to Finland. I just realised I accidentally punched a lamp. I'm going to fix that. Uh-oh. Oh, dear. Good news, everyone. I fixed the lamp. Okay. I was in Sweden, and I did get hit by this tremendous rainstorm. And fortunately, I found this built shelter, which is there for hikers. So, soaking wet, I lay down there and just watched the rain for a really long time. And there was this very mingled sense of helplessness and isolation, because I am alone, and I am a long way from anywhere safe, and I am uncomfortable. But I am in a shelter, and the rain is not landing on me. And I get to have this sense of separation from the peril outside, that gives me this feeling of serenity, of being at peace. Because as much as I'm in a difficult situation, I am separated from it. And I get to observe and not have to go through the hardship.
It's almost, for me, it's that kind of sense of, there's nothing more I can do now. You mentioned like being there for a long time, just like, well, I'll wait till it stops. And as much as it kind of hems you in, it also kind of creates that kind of safe space. And I'm glad that like we can connect over that. And that's something that I found in this book. And I imagine there must be other bits in this book that must speak to those types of feelings in other people. That's only the vibe I got. Like those are two examples that connected with us. I definitely feel like when they talk about like how they were playing or certain other little adventures or interactions with the neighbours, it's the type of thing that kind of would throw out those sort of special feelings about interacting with the world or nostalgia that other people could kind of connect to.
Mm. Especially, I guess, if you like Finnish pancakes. Dunkin' pancakes must be one hell of a thing to the Finns, because good lord, are they constantly eating pancakes.
I mean, I can't think of what else you want for breakfast, but yes, you're totally right. I think they go for a picnic at one point.
I don't think they're eating these for breakfast. I think they're having these for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
I mean, they definitely are. There's a bit where they have like a nighttime celebration. And then I was like, I'll go bring out the pancakes.
I should go to Finland.
You should.
It's got lots of lakes. That's nice. I only ever go hiking to cold and wet locations. I've gone to the south of England, I've gone to Scotland, I've gone to Sweden. I wouldn't really want to add Finland to that list. My next hiking location plan, aside from one next month, which is Scotland, again, is to go to Spain. My plan is to go there, you're going to kick me for this, go there during August next year, which is going to be very hot.
You madman.
Because I want to line it up with the total solar eclipse.
Oh no, that will be nice. To be fair, but I'm with you. I'm genuinely, if I'm going to go out for a hike, I want it to be overcast. I want it to be a cool 12 degrees. It's plenty hot enough for me. Much rather get rained on than feel like my neck's about to burn off.
Yeah, it's going to be a new challenge.
I like food. Do you know who also...
But I'll just stand next to my oven for a couple of hours, get used to it.
Do you know who also likes to go out for nice long walks? And that's Snufkin. So let's come back to Snufkin.
Yes.
I wanted to chat about this guy. Because he's quite interesting. Because firstly, he's sort of the only, air quotes here you can't see when you listen to this, human character in this book.
Yeah. I'm not sure what he is. Because he suddenly seems to hibernate, just like a Moomin does.
He does seem to hibernate. But the way he's actually drawn, and there are illustrations throughout this book... By the way, the Moomins as a franchise, I believe the Terry Jensen wrote the books, also wrote a lot of the comics. There are many, many, many Moomin comics out there that expand on lore. So you can take the artwork as a true reflection of what these characters envisioned as in the author's mind. Looks human. Looks very human. But this isn't a point. A bit more human. Like how the Moomins look like a hippo and Sniff looks like a rabbit, rat, kangaroo. Snufkin looks like a human.
Very human. Like a big
I love some of the traits in Snufkin, some of the personality ideas. Firstly, Snufkin, there's this big thing that's pointed out that Snufkin's not about possessions. That Snufkin was like born with the clothes that he wears. And that is it. And there's even a bit where actually... Moomin kind of goes out and goes, yeah, I've never questioned where he first came from. I like the fact that he's like his, I think, what do they call it? It's not like his handpipe. It's his mouth flute. It's given a slightly odd name. Is it wind? Is it just windpipe?
Are you talking about a pan flute?
Pan flute.
I don't remember, Duncan, I'm sorry.
But it is a pan flute. It's something like that.
Are you talking about a mouth organ?
Mouth organ! Is that a thing? Is that a Moomin thing?
I think that's what an ocarina is called. Or maybe it's a harmonica.
These are the questions that Moomin leave you with. I love how someone probably local is like, yeah, mouth organ, guys, what are you on about? You English speakers. Oh, I'd love it if it was like a literal translation that happened. And it's like...
Okay, first of all, mouth organ is a thing that people do say, Duncan, and it's a harmonica.
Okay, I have never heard the term mouth organ. It's a harmonica. I have learnt. I like the fact that this guy, he sort of drives the sense of adventure.
Forget all that. Forget everything we just said. This is weird. Hang on. I'm about to read something aloud. The harmonica, also known as a French harp or a mouth organ.
No, it's not. What? French harp's
yeah,
a different
it's
thing.
It's not. French, you can't have the French horn and the French harp. It's not a harp. It's not a stringed instrument. It's a woodwind instrument.
I am baffled. Is this what the AI came up with?
This is not what the AI came up with. It's for the front page of Wikipedia.
Oh, Wikipedia,
I can't believe they put French harp before mouth organ.
What's wrong with the word harmonica? It's unique. You know what it is. Allows you to play harmonies. Simple. Unlike any other instrument.
I genuinely would be happier if it said, the harmonica, also known as the mouth organ, or that thing Bob Dylan always has around his neck.
I would also accept that, absolutely. And Snufkin took the thing that Bob Dylan always has, and it was his most treasured possession. I like his vibe, and what I actually find really interesting about Snufkin's sort of relaxed sort of approach to adventure is I think that actually is what projects the most sense of peace and serenity into the world. Snufkin doesn't go around with a tent, like Snufkin isn't worried about what's out there. He's just going for a nice walk, and he's going to walk for miles, and he's going to be fine. He's not prepping, he's not rationing up, it's like he's just going out for like a casual Sunday stroll, and he can just keep strolling. And everything's going to be fine. Yeah, he'll find enough food that he needs. He'll sleep when he feels like it. Like, he has just... The needs and wants and concerns of the world do not affect Snufkin.
Oh, God, that's so nice. That is... Duncan, you put it so well. That is so peaceful. Oh, God. That's what I wish my hiking trips were like.
Reading this book, I genuinely had my own sense of, like, maybe I want to go on a hiking trip. But then I sat and I thought... And I remembered the last time I went for a walk, genuinely was only about 3 hours long. And the heat, and the need for water, and then the long wait at the bus stop for getting the bus back to the car park. Mate, it was mental.
Duncan, the worst part of any hike is the first 3 hours and the last 3 hours.
Well, in that case, I only experienced the bad bits.
Moral of that story, don't go for a 6-hour hike.
But that also implies that if you want to have more good hike than bad hike, you have to be out for at least 13 hours.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty much probably the perfect length of a hike. I mean, not 13 hours straight.
Okay.
You know, 7 hours a hike, rest for the night, 7 hours a hike. That's probably ideal. It's just not really worth it in terms of the time spent to, like, go and to pack up your bags and bring all your gear and stuff.
To be fair, I did... in the UK, Duke of Edinburgh Awards, which you need to do, you learn a skill, you volunteer in the community, and you have to go on like a hike or the expedition. Honestly, most fun. Absolutely adored it. I was not expecting to like it, but when we actually went and did that, I was like, why don't I do this more often? Did you do it?
Good question, Duncan. I love it too. I recently helped out with my colleges. Duke of Edinburgh training run, and I had a really good time just helping out, even though I didn't really get to contribute much. I did bronze, silver, and gold.
Oh, I'm a mere bronze.
Technically speaking, I never did actually get the gold, because I literally did everything. I did my volunteering, I did my learning, I did my expedition, I got it all signed off, but my buddy needed to get some things signed off, and I wanted to go to Buckingham Palace. If you finish the whole gold thing, you get to go to Buckingham Palace, and you at the time got to meet the Duke of Edinburgh. We can't do that anymore because we don't have a Duke of Edinburgh because he's dead, but you could do that, and we didn't do it because he didn't finish his paperwork, and to be honest, I couldn't be bothered, and I didn't really care about going to see the Duke of Edinburgh, so I did everything. I just didn't submit my paperwork, and I consider myself to have completed my Duke of Edinburgh gold. Thank you very much. You can... and you what? If you've got a problem with that?
Okay. Didn't... And that is how we got from Snufkin to damning the late Prince Philip. Going back to the Moomins. So... we've touched on some of our favourite characters. Talking about... Actually, we've barely talked about Moomin Papa. Moomin Papa is the male version of Moomin Mama in the sense that he's exactly what a late 1940s, early 50s father should be, in the sense that he's slightly absent, but he is still actually very attentive and nice.
Yeah, that's true. I guess we should hone in on it as a sort of paternalistic thing, where it is a sort of father knows best type situation, but it probably was nice to have an expression of masculine leadership in the 1940s, which wasn't in any way cruel or brutal, which seems to be an extreme rarity.
Yes, okay. There is that. So it...
To be honest, Duncan, I don't have that much to say about Papa Moomin. He's pretty straightforwardly. He does what he does.
He wears his top hat. Moomin Mama carries her handbag.
Yep.
They are the most idolized parents.
Designs that have to be differentiated by, like, typical gender expressions. So he has a hat, she has a purse. Moomin Troll gets to be completely bland, but Snork Maiden has to have, like, big, big eyelashes and a fringe so that you can tell them apart, and she has to be the girl, which means she has to be differentiated from him, the default, the boy.
Okay. So I think we're rubbing up against the next point we really need to chat about. This is something I think... So I once went to a Moomin, exhibition experience in London. And I learned a lot there about Tove Jensen. And the main thing that I really took away from that is the fact that how much of her life experience as a queer lesbian woman she'd actually put into the Moomins.
Hmm, okay. I don't know anything about Tove Jensen, so I'm all ears.
So, a little bit about her personal life. Tove Jensen, she did date in her life both men and women, but her life partner, who I believe she is with for close to like 45 years, is and lived semi-openly with, was a woman. And bear in mind, this is a time in Finland where it was illegal to be homosexual up to the year 1971. I think I've got my history right there.
So pretty early then.
I mean, relatively speaking, doing quite well. So one of the key kind of ideas that she wanted to put into the Moomins, without being overly explicit, is firstly the idea of sort of found family and chosen family and the value put in that.
Sure, that's nice.
So that's one of the main things we kind of see. Although there's this core family unit of Moomin, Troll, Mama, Papa, characters like Sniff, Snufkin, everyone just kind of comes into the house and they're all treated sort of one and the same. It very much gets the impression that, like, if anyone rocks up, great, we'll make a bed for you to sleep on. You're eating breakfast and lunch and dinner with us. It's not questioned. There's actually a bit which I don't think is in this book, and I'm kind of sure where I saw it first. It must be in the animated version, where the Moomins, when they go out, they lock up the house, and then they leave a key next to the door. You know this bit?
I don't know this bit, but it sounds very cute.
Well, they leave a key next to it, just in case if anyone's drops by and needs to let themselves in.
I mean, that's just how it is in some parts of Canada. I remember when it was, Michael Moore made Bowling for Columbine. He just walked around, like, Canada and just opened people's doors and said, just checking, because no one had their doors locked. And also in some parts, you're like, there are polar bears, so everyone needs their cars unlocked so that you can shelter from the polar bears.
The BBC does a show called Race Across the World, and in their Canada season, it's a show where people, as it says, race across the world. In the Canada season, they made a big thing about that. And they're like, yeah, just so you're aware, when you're going through this area, if you have to, you socially awkward British folks, just dive into any house. Please, don't waste time.
No, I think a good British person would still knock and ask politely to be let in, even if it did mean getting mauled by a polar bear. I mean, it's just the right thing to do.
What they would do is they would turn around and apologise to the polar bear for the inconvenience first. Just the right thing. But the other kind of key sort of point of subtly queer representation in the Moomins, particularly in this Moomin book, are the characters of, and I hope I get this first one right, Thin Gummy and Bob.
Okay, sure.
So Geordie, who are these two characters?
They're these two weirdos who rock around. They want to steal a ruby.
I think I'm going to have to go back on this. They, okay, maybe still is the right word. I think Gummy and Bob are two individuals who show up at the Moomin House. They're two little people, in the sense that they originally get mistaken for, like, mice. They have a cute little way of talking, Also, I'd like to point out that their names in Swedish is like Tofslan and Vifslan. So the Thingummy and Bob thing was just a result of translation. But one of the things people talk to is firstly the fact that these are two very close individuals, have their almost kind of secret language when they interact with each other. And one of the things is the fact that they sort of have to, the common reading is that, well, they carry around this big suitcase with them and it's their secret, they keep it, but what's in the suitcase is what they think is the most beautiful thing in the world. And the general reading is, you know, this is sort of a show of having to sort of hide your, you know, homosexual romantic life from society. You know, it's this thing, you share it with another person. It, to you, it's the most beautiful thing, but you're not allowed to just come out and present it.
Wow, okay, that's interesting. I did pay attention to the, like, oh, it's the most beautiful thing in the world, but I didn't attach to that anything more than a sense of typical whimsy from the book. But no, that, of course, that makes a lot of sense as a reading, and probably is what Torve was putting down. Yeah, that's great. And it also amuses me now that I'm realizing, I'm like, I did not question what these characters' relationship was. I was just like, yeah, it's the two of them. And I just sort of accepted them as a, like, as a unit. But I never interrogated that.
I think it's sort of important in this, like, it's kind of widely accepted, and I believe the author has even, you know, did talk about this. It's not something that necessarily is, it is, you know, decoded and a matter of interpretation based on knowledge of the author's life. But it's kind of sweet that that's where it kind of came from, that the author's like, no, this is what inspired me to create these characters. And one of the things that she thought was important is the fact that when these characters reveal, so in the book it's a ruby, it's this precious ruby that they have, and they're keeping it because they took it away from a creature called a gonk, who's an icy cold influence. And their argument is, well, the gonk doesn't, you know, doesn't recognize its beauty the way, you know, the way we do. It means everything to us. It doesn't matter to them. They don't associate the value. It's the value it means to us that matters, not what it is.
Yeah, no, I see exactly what you're saying, is that, like, you know, we're taking something that's been discarded and we're making something of value out of it. We appreciate it. And on one hand, when I read it, I'm like, okay, this is like a sort of silly idea of, like, thieves justifying themselves. Like that scene in Guardians of the Galaxy where Rocket's like, well, what if I want something more than someone? Can I take it then? But no, yeah, I didn't appreciate that deeper queer reading into it, where it's like, you can tarnish something because you don't think it has any value, relationships between people of the same gender, whereas we see the beauty in it and we value it and we treasure it, and we're going to wish to have an exact duplicate of it.
Yes, that goes on to the scene with the Hobgoblin. So at the end, the Hobgoblin is also looking for this super rare ruby, which again, but sub in queer love into that to replace the word ruby. And at the end, how do they sort of get around it? They're like, we'll just have two of them. It's actually, this is a really nice, like, puzzling out your genie moment, which I really enjoy. Beating the genie is quite a fun trope. I find, I'm trying to think of what's a really good example. Annoyingly, my brain's now just filling my head with monkey paw examples. I'm like, no, that's not one I want to talk about, Duncan. Go to the back. Monkey paw, by the way. Am I right?
Yeah, but you're talking about tricky wishes, and there's a satisfaction that comes from a character getting past the tricky parts of wishes and overcoming the wishmaker, the wish granter, rather.
It's a nice trope. By the way, if you ever are in the monkey paw situation, I have solved it. The answer is don't wish. There you go.
Great job, Duncan. I was really stuck on that. I've had this thing in my drawer for ages, and I keep trying to come up with the right solution.
Just move it along. This scene's quite interesting because the Hobgoblin isn't actually being malevolent in any real way. He kind of comes down and goes, I want it. And they're like, no. He goes, how do I deal with this? And what comes up is the fact that he, through the conversation, it's like, he says, I can only grant other people's wishes. I can't grant my own. And so what's the solution? Well, they ask a wish that he wants. I guess, I suppose that's the same as wishing a genie to be free, to be fair.
Somewhat, it's very sweet, because the whole point is that I could give you anything, and they say, well, what we choose to wish for is for you to be happy. And that's very, it's generous, and it's sweet, and it's kind, and it's fluffy and nice, and it's a really nice way to end the book. And Genie's in such a good mood after this, they say, that he says, and he let everyone make wishes, and if it was a bad wish, he let them try again.
I feel like, sorry.
One thing I had to say in that last scene, I was like, I don't quite like this, which is that Moomintroll is sad because Snufkin left, and his mum wishes, her wish is, I wish that my son was not sad that his friend left. And I'm like, you should let him feel his feelings. It is framed in kind of a nice way, because the feeling of sadness isn't, like, squashed. It's replaced by anticipation for Snufkin's return. And in a way, that's kind of just CBT, you know? But still, I was like, I don't know about that. That seems a little unfair to little Moomintroll. He should be allowed to puzzle his way through his difficult feelings.
I was just relieved, because at this point, we hadn't really established what the Hobgoblin game was. I'm like, oh dear God, is the Hobgoblin going to like make him forget that Snufkin exists? Or is he going to make it so that he just doesn't care for this him at all? And it's like, oh no, that's like the nicest interpretation. He's like the good DM. You cast Wish and he's like, listen, you phrased that really badly, but I'm going to give you what you want.
Moomintroll's wish is, we're having this really nice meal. No, I just remember the joke that comes after this. We're having this really great meal. I wish that this table with the food on it would fly to wherever Snufkin is right now. And it flies away, but it takes someone's book that was sitting at a table with it, and then that guy has to wish for his book to come back.
What tops that is that the book comes back and he goes, this isn't my book. And Hobgoblin's like, it's a better one. Shush.
Oh, man. What a nice Hobgoblin he was.
He is. He's a nice character. And I really like the fact that for the most of the book, he's given this quite slight ominous build-up. You've got to hide the ruby from him. We don't want him coming back for his hat. They sort of see him on the horizon. Mm-hmm. There's a bit when, I believe it's when the storm first passed, and they look out to the horizon, and they just see him like riding through the air on the back of his Black Panther. And I'm like, that's a freaking intimidating vibe. To see this figure just moving across the skyline. Though,
Duncan, you know, discussing the book in this way, I'm really glad we did it. Because talking about how nice the book is and how sweet the book is, it has actually made me appreciate it more. I was really worried before we started this episode. Like, I really didn't feel like I was able to come to grips with the book as much as I should. And that probably is still true. And clearly I didn't get as much out of it as you, because you had more information about the book and what to look out for in terms of its different readings. But I'm really glad that we did this episode and we talked about it, and that I feel much better about this book. I am sort of acutely aware with all the books we review that because we did our top 50 episode, we are next year going to have to do our top 100. And now I'm like, fucking hell, it would be such a dick move if I had to vote the Moomin family, the Finn family troll. Wait, what's it called again?
Finn family Moomin.
Sorry, I was supposed to, I kept trying to get Moomin troll in there. The Finn family Moomin. Also, cut away. It took me ages to realize that they're the Finn family Moomins, because they're Moomins and their family and they're Finns. They're still Finn nationals. I was like, why are they called this? So silly. Anyway, I appreciate this book more now. I feel like I will be able to do it justice when the time comes to compare it against Straight Razor's Cure and The Heroes.
I would hope so, Geordie. That is what you want. I'm just kind of glancing back through the book at the moment. I like the fact that Tarzan's referenced. Like, they expressly say at one point, "And playing Tarzan in the jungle," added Moomin Troll.
Yeah.
Nice. I also like the talk. The Moomins have this odd sense of time, in the sense that their world is a fantasy land and it's very apart, but there are little details like the wireless and...
Yes, yes. I really find that cute, though. I feel like those tiny slivers of modernity coming in, even though obviously it's antiquated modernity, I really like that. I really like just the tiny little traces of the modern world stumbling into the fantastical.
It is true. Sorry, Jordy, do you know what my brain's doing now? I'm thinking, does that mean there's an Echovice Burrows in the Moomin world? Or is Tarzan possibly being written by someone else? Or a version thereof? Or, and if it was written by Burrows, yeah?
Or is Tarzan a real guy in the Moomin world? I mean, he's a real guy in the world of Tarzan. Why wouldn't he be a real guy in the Moomins? He could be a historical
You're
figure.
You're absolutely right, and this is the best realisation ever. I will have to consider this canon. And as we all know, Tarzan is essentially canon to John Carter. And yeah, it's all one, isn't it? It's fine. All of it has worked.
Absolutely. And Duncan, really, what you're asking very silly things, because as we all know, Tarzan and the Moomins are canon to each other's worlds because they both show up in Leave Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Do they?
No.
Yeah, I mean, genuinely flicking from my brain going, oh yeah, then the Martians invade, and then Mr. Hyde attacks the Invisible Man brutally, and then does Moomin Troll show up?
No, there are no Moomins that I'm aware of in the Leave Extraordinary Gentlemen. I'm going to bring up something I learned recently. I don't know how this can possibly be legal, but Elric is in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
No. Which book?
I don't know. I only saw it on the, like, Elric subreddit, but there's a pale, white-haired swordsman.
Okay, so the deal is, it's from League of Extraordinary Gentlemen Black Dossier, and the character is actually Monsieur Zenith, who's a villain from the Blake Sexton detective stories. I've never read them, I don't know. And he, the original character, was an albino with white hair and red eyes and a gentlemanly manner, who was a chief inspiration for Elric. So, they just smashed the two characters together.
Well, kind of me intrigued.
Shouldn't be. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen's really bad.
Okay, the original is rough. I think Volume 2 is when they do the War of the Worlds story arc, and I think that one's actually just kind of banging. You want to see Mr. Hyde fighting the Martian tripods? You do. It's fun.
I guess I do. You're right. I do want to see that.
Thank you very much.
Duncan, before we go any further, thoughts on the movie adaptation of A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
It's definitely in my guilty pleasure camp. It's not
I
good,
did enjoy
really
it when I saw
fun.
It for the first time. It's stupid as hell, but man, am I like, I should watch that again. I bet it slaps.
To be honest, it has what the Van Helsing film that came out around the same time didn't quite land. Not that I don't kind of like that film too, but like,
I hate that
just
film.
Has this sense of momentum. That's it. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I think, just moves fast enough that I kind of just go, yeah, sure, whatever. You know the Invisible Man is a terrible human being, so you've made up a new character to be the Invisible Man. Go for it.
Duncan, do you have anything more to say about the Moomins?
Other than the wholesome delight, and that I full-heartedly recommend this to anyone who has a young person to share it with, and that I feel that if you, to be brutally honest, actually, no, it's more than that. You got to be in the right frame of mind. You got to know that you're about to read a story that's going to take you back to like 7 and under. But I think it's, you know, it's short enough and it's kind enough that if you're in the mood for something that is just going to give you a big warm hug, The Moomins is well written, and its sense of environment and the description, I don't think we've given enough praise to that. We talked about the storm and the sea, but the sense of the seasons and the valley and the quaint countrysideness of it all is so wonderfully described. Like, there's some really nice prose in this book.
It's true. It is really well written, considering it's a translation. Yeah, and if you're gonna have, like, a national favourite cartoon series, then the Finns, you're very lucky that you got the Moomin, and not something as culturally loaded as Tintin. Or, I don't know, the Beano, Just William. I also recommend this to young people, and to people who have young people. I personally don't think this is something that I could really connect with as someone who is not a young person, or who has a young person. It is just a little bit too capital K kiddish for me. But I did like it, and I did appreciate its value, even though it didn't quite mesh with me at the time of my reading, for reasons that were not Tove Jansson's fault.
I also think it's just really nice for us who are trying to explore, you know, is this just fantasy? That fantasy goes so far beyond your epics or your dark or grimdark fantasies. This is a fantasy, not just because they're Moomins, but we've got a magic flying man on a black leopard. We've got a magic cat that turns things into different things. We've got all these weird and wonderful creatures. I mean, mention, like, in great detail, the bird creatures or the little lightning rod worm thingies. Like, this is a really imaginative world.
Yes,
and
that's true.
And it's a joy to explore and learn about.
And another important fantastical element to it is that sense of pastoral peace. There's a certain type of person who really likes the shyer parts of the Lord of the Rings over everything else. And I understand why. I don't understand why those people pretend that the Lord of the Rings is something other than what it is, and think that it's just sort of about the Shire. In a way, the Lord of the Rings is about the Shire, but it's more about the absence of the Shire. But to hear some people talk about it, they would think that the Shire was like heaven on earth, as opposed to just, it's the English countryside. It's literally just the English countryside. I don't understand
how. Which is to say, rolling green hills, lots of bigots.
Yes, exactly, exactly. I found this out really recently. I think it's very funny. Duncan, where does Bilbo live?
Hobbiton.
Okay, can you be more specific? What's the name of his house?
Oh, God. I feel shame for not knowing this.
Bag End? That's right, Bag End. Apparently, Tolkien named it Bag End because he did not like the word cul-de-sac. So cul-de-sac is obviously a street that comes to an end. You know, it's just like straight and then it finishes. It doesn't carry on to another street. He didn't like that this French word had infiltrated English language, so he named Bilbo's house Bag End. It's because cul-de-sac means the end of the sack, the end of the bag.
I love Tolkien. Not just because he wrote two exceptional books and some other fantasy notes, but I'm not going to lie, they vary in quality. But because if he didn't like a
I'd
word...
I'd rather read The Silmarillion again and Two Towers, but...
If he didn't like a word, he just rewrote it. How do you spell dwarfs? However Tolkien decides he wants to spell dwarfs.
Exactly. I appreciate this book. I like this book. I think that it appeals to people in a lot of different ways because it's pastoral, because it has these light, nice, Roald Dahl-esque imagination. And I'd recommend it to people who have kids. And if you don't have kids and you just want to escape into it, then maybe it'll work more for you than it did for me. I can certainly see why people might get a little bit obsessed over this one.
I completely agree. Beautiful work, beautiful science. Great thing you brought up Tolkien, by the way. Apparently there's a super rare kind of edition of The Hobbit where Tove Jansson did the illustrations. Did her illustrations
for
The Hobbit.
Oh my god, that's probably so cute.
So I don't know what I really have to add to that. If anyone's seen it, an actual copy, I'd happily take it off your hands. I can afford about 50p at the moment because I blew all my money on Conan comics. But there is that. Right, Geordie, this has been my pick. I'm very happy that we had it. But what are we going to look up to next? What shall be the next big read? Or the next little read?
Okay. So, to be honest, I feel like as much as our project is to look at and span the wide breadth of fantasy, this is obviously a very specific type of fantasy, which we've just read. And the one before that, with The Sheep Farmer's Daughter, it's kind of just a miss, to be honest. It's just something that is not that interesting. I've gone with a safe bet, to be honest. I've gone for one that I think we're just going to have a good time in kind of a straightforward fantasy adventure sort of way.
I'm looking forward. Oh, what's it going to be?
So I've read this author before. I've even read parts of this series before. I know, Duncan, that you have not, but I also know that you're going to have an amazing time. This is the safest bet I can really pick on this podcast, even more so than certain Conan stories. We are going to be reading the first chronological book in The Legend of Dritzt by reading Homeland by R.A. Salvatore.
Oh, okay. Forgotten Realms, D&D tie-in.
That's right.
I'm very happy, Geordie. You're coming to my level of tie-in novels. All
yeah,
good.
I'm ready for this. R.A. Salvatore wrote the Attack of the Clones book.
You say that like it's like the hottest shit ever.
I don't know what it's like. I mean, the Empire Strikes Back. What am I saying? The Revenge of the Sith book was definitely an improvement over the movie. I think it would be hard not to improve on the Attack of the Clones.
No, I've heard it. If we're just talking about improving on the movie, don't worry. All the prequel books have you covered. But no, I'm very excited to read this. I'm familiar with the Icewind Dale trilogy, although I haven't actually read it. I own it. So,
oh,
and I know this is
I'm sorry, I picked a different book then.
It's okay.
Yes.
This is a prequel trilogy to that trilogy.
The first books that introduced Dritzt were the Icewind Dale trilogy, only one of which is set in the location of Icewind Dale. Oops. It really should be called the Halfling's Gem series, because that's what it's actually about. I really like those books. They're not perfect, but they're really enjoyable. And apparently, considering they were the first books which R.A. Salvatore wrote with the character of Dritzt, who he then became obsessed with, who then became an absolute staple of 80s and 90s fantasy, where so many Dungeons and Dragons players were playing playing drow rangers with panther companions and two scimitars, that it genuinely became banned at certain conventions. This is apparently where it hits its stride, going back to Dritz's origins. And I liked the books where he's imperfect, so I'm really excited to see what he's like when he's on good form.
Well, I'm excited to experience this book with you, Geordie, next time. But in the meantime, if you are a fan of the Moomins and you want to tell us what we did wrong, what we missed, how we should actually be continuing the series, because actually, Midwinter in Moomin Valley is the greatest book ever written, then let us know. Also, let us know who Little Mai is and why she isn't in this book. She's in the animated version. I don't know when she appears in the book. Is she an animated original? Let me know, please. The best place, as always, is our Instagram, It's This Is Fantasy Podcast. Also, hit us on Gmail at itsthefantasypodcast@gmail.com. Also, Blue Sky at Is This Just Fantasy? No, Just Fantasy. Blue Sky is Just Fantasy. I will bear that in mind. As always, it's been a pleasure. I've been your host, Duncan Nicol.
Duncan, I just remembered that at a certain point in this book, Snork Maiden says that her brother is going to get a typewriter for Christmas, but we both know that they sleep all the way through the winter. So what the hell is going on? 0 out of 10. Never read this book. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey. Goodbye.
Bye.